Hello, this is Andrew Heaton, and you're listening to The Reason Podcast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. The Reason Podcast is where I speak with Reason senior editors Nick Gillespie, Catherine Mangue Ward, and Matt Welch. Today we're going to discuss gun control laws, birth control, some sex scandal schadenfreude. But before we do that, we're going to get to the latest Trump on Republican slap fight, which involves both Bob Corker, who is a senior Republican in the Senate, and Rex Tillerson, the present Secretary of State. The feud between Trump and Corker happened all over the weekend in a variety of manners, mostly Twitter on the president's end and a few interviews with Corker. According to Trump, Senator Bob Corker begged me to endorse him for re-election in Tennessee. I said no, and he dropped out. He continued poking at him. Meanwhile, Corker says that the White House has become an adult daycare center, and somebody obviously missed their shift this morning. And has gone back and forth on it. But from what I gather, the break between senior Republicans and Trump is further happening, and this time it's happening with the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate. And that was in part due to the fact that Trump was also undermining the efforts of Secretary of State Rex Tillerson by saying last week or the week before that he was wasting his time negotiating with North Korea. So we have this infight going on, and we don't have a lot of legislative accomplishments. Matt, are we likely to see any type of detente between Bob Corker and the Republicans, or is this just going to further rip apart any alliance that Trump could have with people in the Senate to exact his plans?
Well, Bob Corker he should be treated, and as all Republicans who have announced their retirement should be treated, as basically the equivalent of former Mexican presidents. Former Mexican presidents always suddenly become brave about how we should really end the drug war. And they never quite get there when they're in office. So you're seeing a lot of the Republicans who locate their courage are the ones who are not running for re-election when they, in terms of the way that they talk about Donald Trump. So Corker is engaged in what seems to be a pretty well mapped out and coordinated exercise, like an intervention on the presidency. I mean, he's had the reporters from the New York Times who wrote this story were talking about how, he had his aides on the call. They were taping it and recording it. You buried the lead there a bit, Heaton. He says we're getting closer to World War III, which is not a small thing for the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee here. I think some of this is a function of the fact that there is no obvious person or even wing that is running United States foreign policy right now. And that's unsettling to a lot of people, regardless of whether you like or dislike Donald Trump's foreign policy. Rex Tillerson seems to be stranded out on one direction. Trump tweeting is its own kind of category of foreign policy. The generals around Trump have their kind of own agenda and send their own messages out there. This is a consistent thing. I talked to John Bolton last week who has the president's ear to some degree on this, and talked precisely about this. Who's running it? And he says there's three different wings running foreign policy. They disagree with one another, and everyone's skeeved out about that. So part of that is that.
But having said that, I think this is a larger issue than foreign policy, because And I think there's a huge amount to pick up on one thread that Matt was talking about with, Corker finding his courage now that he's not running for office again. This is on the Republican Party. I mean, Donald Trump, Donald Trump is a man child. He's a baby. That point is all well taken. How much actual legislation has come across his desk to sign? And, people now, I feel like we're falling into a kind of Republican ploy here of saying, we can't do anything because Trump is insane now. Like they're trying to distance themselves from him. The Senate health care bill the Republican repeal and replace Obamacare bill that died before it ever got to Trump's desk. Where's the budget? You don't need Donald Trump to pass an actual budget and start pushing it through. The fact of the matter is that except for these, kind of bullshit, symbolic bills like a 20-week ban on abortion, which isn't going to go anywhere in the Senate, the Republican Congress has done shit. And they're to blame for this. And they can say, it's like Trump has alienated Mitch McConnell and Bob Corker and, whoever. Who cares? You know, it's like the Republican Party had so long to do everything that it said it wanted to do once it had a Republican president in Congress, you know, in power, and they haven't done shit. It's, I think it's on them, and I think it's wrong. Trump wants the credit; he wants to be the same.
Isn't that one of the things?
But in
that,
fact, it's the legislator. It's the legislators; they're the problem.
Didn't Corker come out on I think Friday? Like he had a line in Washington Post about how he thought that the Republican Party had dropped fiscal responsibility and had dropped its obligation to try and get rid of the debt and that kind of thing. Like, who are there any good players in this, Nick?
I mean, obviously, I think people like Rand Paul for the most part. He's a serious guy. I think Mike Lee is a serious guy. But you know, when it comes to stuff like the Iran deal, you know, they're on the horns of a dilemma because, in fact, it's easy as a senator or as a Republican to criticize the Iran deal when it's going through under a Democratic president. And now that it comes time to have a kind of recertification, a presidential recertification, which they put that into the deal in order to keep tabs on Obama, now they have to kind of be against the deal, even though a Republican is in power and they kind of signed off on it. It gets very complicated very quickly. And it's, you know, it isn't that Trump, I was reading, and Jonathan Martin has said this at the New York Times, the guy that Corker talked to, people at the Washington Post say Trump isn't interested in actually running the government and governing. The Republican Congress hasn't been interested in governing, you know, since Bush left office, and they blew out the jams on every kind of spending and every kind of stupid entitlement program that achieved very little at extremely high cost.
Hey, Catherine, to go back to Matt's statement about Matt's reference to Bob Corker saying World War III may be nigh. I look at it and I think we've got a very bombastic president, but I don't see a lot of movement in terms of actual military buildup or aggression. So I'm not terribly worried myself about World War III, should I be?
I mean, I think this is an interesting case study on what happens when somebody accumulates a fair amount of senior statesman gravitas and then burns it all at once. Because that's what Corker's doing here. He's basically said, okay, I'm on my way out. I think Trump is bad. We're meant to think that he has special knowledge about the ways in which Trump is bad on foreign policy that the rest of us don't have, whereas we can see the ways he's bad in domestic policy by and large. Suggesting that a president is putting us on the verge of World War III is itself somewhat irresponsible and Trumpian in its exaggerated rhetoric. And, you know, I think this is what it makes me think about is the sort of idea of the power of the lame duck, the power of the senior statesman, how those things work together. You know, it's good to have some guys who know they're on their way out, who are just going to burn it all to the ground before they go, you know, speaking truth to power, et cetera, getting the strange new respect that we all crave. But at the same time, that's quite rare. Mostly people are lifers. They get reelected over and over and over. What is the idea of shouting World War III on your way out the door? It's I get why it's tempting, but I'm not sure that it's actually the thing that improves our politics.
Follow on point on that is that a lot of the establishment GOP, and I don't know where Corker falls in because I'm not as familiar with his track record, but the John McCain's of the world, the John Kasich's of the world, the people who are alarmed at the bluster and the incompetence of the Trumpian foreign policy, the vast majority of these people, Bill Kristol, have advocated at various times since the 1990s for preemptive war against North Korea. So
And are themselves masters of bluster. I mean, for John McCain to say, I'm worried about intemperate rhetoric is not exactly a firm place to be standing. I mean, this is, you know, Corker says he concerns me. He would have to concern anyone who cares about the nation. It's like that can simultaneously be true and both grammatically appalling and not helpful to say.
why throw Rex Tillerson under the bus? Is there any rhyme to that, Nick?
I have no idea.
Rhyme or reason?
I don't know. But it's not necessarily the worst thing. And I'm not saying this as somebody who supports Trump, but it's not necessarily the worst thing in the world to have your Secretary of State pushing one thing and the president pushing another when you're dealing with a country like North Korea or even Iran. I mean, I would prefer to see an American foreign policy that is first hammered out at home and actually represents both the consensus of the American people and our best interests. And we haven't had that in forever. You know, it's not necessarily the worst thing in the world to hang your Secretary of State out to dry. You know, when it comes to dealing with North Korea, whether that affects other things. And what I'm actually more concerned about is all of the stuff that Trump has done, like pulling out of TPP and constantly talking about renegotiating NAFTA. Those strike me as much more important. North Korea is a Chinese client state, and I would like to believe that the U.S. government is largely working through you know, connections and ties with the Chinese government in order to control and contain North Korea. Rex Tillerson, you know, it's, oh my God, throw Rex Tillerson under the bus. Like, Rex Tillerson is such a big deal. You know, it's like, do we know what he thinks about anything?
I like the fact that 10 days ago or so, the news crossed the desk that there was a quote unquote suicide pact between Rex Tillerson, I think Steven Mnuchin, and somebody else in the cabinet, where they decided, like, if one of us quits, all three of us quits at once. And this was barely even a headline for half an hour, that there's a suicide pact among three members of the cabinet. It's really funny.
Which is not standard, is it? I think that's kind of abnormal.
It brings to mind when Jeb Bush did, you know, I think he absolutely called it correct in one of the primary debates for the GOP when he called Trump the chaos candidate. There's no question that that's how he's going to govern. And, you know, the people who signed on with him, I think, have to understand that. And maybe the reality of it is more disturbing than, you know, the preview. But again, you know, I would love to see the Republican Congress is constantly acting as if they don't have any power, they don't have any control. And it seems to me that they're the ones who are in an adult daycare. There's 100 senators, you know, a majority are Republican. There's a Republican majority in the House of Representatives. Let them do some heavy lifting for a change, because we have an idiot president. That much is clear. But Trump is also going to sign whatever comes across his desk if he thinks it will help him look good, you know?
I see why you're saying that, and I think you're basically right. But I also do think it's legitimate for them to say, you know, we're trying to legislate in this environment, and even if we did our best work, which they are currently not doing, but even if they really got it together and got a great bill— it's like 50-50. I don't think it's true that Trump will sign anything that comes across his desk. Like, the six-dimensional chess of Donald Trump might fully mean that they actually got a full-scale Obamacare repeal to his desk, and he might not sign it.
Yeah, but they didn't.
And I think that's got to be disincentivizing legislating.
Yeah, seriously, I don't disagree. I mean, Trump could do that, and, you know, who knows how that would play out. But the fact of the matter is that if the Republicans can only, you know, wait until they know that Trump will sign something, that doesn't explain why they don't have a budget. They haven't had budgets in years. They didn't come up with a coherent repeal and replace strategy when they had all the time in the world since the Supreme Court certified Obamacare. I mean, they're clowns. And this is, you know, and not all of them, but it's like, you know, I don't even know at this point how you bring pressure to bear on Congress, because, you know, Tim Murphy, who resigned last week in a sex scandal, he's somewhat representative. In the last two elections, he won 100% of the vote. I mean, he got more votes than fucking Castro in his last two elections. And, you know, because he ran unopposed. I don't know how you force the Republican Congress to actually do what they're supposed to do.
Well, the way you do it is by not giving them power, because when they're not in power, that's the only time that they're worth a shit on the stuff that we moderately like. Another thing that didn't get as much play as it could have, just because there's always a lot of fireworks, is that Mick Mulvaney, who is like one of the handful of the best House Freedom Caucus members when it comes to holding the hard line on the budget, he busted Republican Congress's chops just 2 years ago in the Wall Street Journal about how their new budget was blowing the sequestration caps and was now going to blow up the deficit. And that's a bad thing. We should never blow up the deficit. He literally was on the Sunday show chat shows last week saying that we need new deficits. Because he's now the director of the Office of Management and Budget, that's the price of getting the tax cuts that he wants. When Republicans hold power, they are terrible So this is we are discovering who the Republicans that are any good are, and you can count them on one hand. This is not the party of fiscal conservatism. It never is, unless it does not hold power, and then it uses that as a temporary excuse to put the brakes on a Democratic president.
I want to talk really briefly about, I don't know if y'all read the New Yorker profile of Tillerson, which maybe that itself should have been a death knell, like a even moderately sympathetic New Yorker profile of a Trump administration.
Is this back at the beginning when he first came in, or is this a recent thing?
No, recent.
Okay. No, I didn't know.
And it's one sort of tidbit that's in there is about how shortly after he was confirmed, Tillerson's talking with Trump. And Trump is pissed because there are laws that prohibit American businesses from bribing foreign officials, which is a hell of a thing to say to the Exxon CEO, you know, whose life would be awfully a lot easier if that law didn't exist. And Tillerson sticks up for the law, according to, you know, some unnamed third party, and says, you know, we should bring the rest of the world up to our standards. And, you know, I feel like you can only have that conversation so many times before Donald Trump is just like GTFO.
Yeah, you know? I rather like Rex Tillerson. I think he got a lot of unnecessary heat when he got confirmed. He thinks climate change is happening, which is an interesting position for a Republican diplomat. He was the head of
and Exxon CEO.
And Exxon CEO. He was the head of the Boy Scouts of America, which Nick and I were a part of, and are Eagle Scouts.
Enough
and,
with the Boy Scout bragging
and,
already.
Well, and he was in favor of,
you know,
of letting in
my Eagle Scout project is still helping people avoid fires in Middletown, New Jersey.
Nice. Uh-huh. That's I've
how'd that go?
I don't know. You know, I mean, look, you go into Boy Scouts either to start fires or to put them out. So, I was in the latter camp, I guess.
No, that's true. But what I wanted to get at is I like Tillerson, and I think that he has a lot of positions that are more nuanced than he's usually given credit for. But we can contrast him with, say, Jeff Sessions, who I would love to quit, who is a part of rolling back a lot of things. One of the things that he brought up on, I think it was Friday, as part of a general Trump religious liberties push, is that there would be broader exceptions for companies to employ religious liberties, both for issuing contraceptives, which was dictated by Obamacare that it had to be provided by employer insurance, and in terms of latitude of hiring people that were part of were gay or transgender or things like that. So the Trump administration and Jeff Sessions in particular are pushing these things. First of all, just from a policy perspective, Matt, the contraceptive mandate, as I understand it, means that employers would not have to provide contraceptives, but in the sort of safety net presently available for low-income women and that kind of thing, that's a separate issue in terms of birth control, right?
I don't know.
You're telling me this doesn't directly affect you as a middle class male?
I'll go straight to the secondary issue and let the more overeat among us get into the exact aspects of contraceptive policy. Generally speaking, this country, we spend way too much time enacting our social policy by telling businesses what to do. And so what you're going to find the more that you have businesses, carry out policy to their employees, the more that you're going to force them to do things that they don't want to do or that offends them. I mean, I wrote a piece 3 years ago called Big Government is Offensive, exactly on the contraceptive mandate. The bigger the government is, the more that it's going to support something that you find totally objectionable, either in one direction or its opposite direction. It's just a fact, I think, including like subsidizing football and crap like that. A lot of people find that offensive. Great. Stop subsidizing thing. The bigger government is, the more it's going to offend your values. And that's completely true in this case. We should stop trying. If we ever had the courage at the beginning of the Obamacare debate, let alone the beginning of health policy a long time ago, to say, hey, look, let's stop making this having anything to do with the employer and having everything to do with the actual end user, where they own their own policies and can shop around for different aspects of those policies, then we would just be having a completely different conversation, because then people would be able to choose an insurance provider that had this contraceptive policy or this other one over here instead of making it all about you know, telling Hobby Lobby what they should do.
Well, I'm gonna pivot then to our Overeed member of the podcast, Catherine. Do you think that there should be religious exceptions for mandated birth control?
First of all, fuck all of y'all.
Yeah.
Second
please.
Of all,
I'm with you, sister. I'm with you, sister.
I don't. I'm gonna quote a fellow double X Reason staffer. Stephanie Slade wrote about this Sessions memo. She does open up by noting that Sessions is the worst human who ever humaned, and we should be clear on that. However, her headline, which I think pretty much captures it, is "Left loses its mind over Jeff Sessions memo that brazenly restates existing law," and that's what happened here. I mean, this is. You know, we've got press releases saying that it's an all-out assault on LGBTQ people and a sweeping license to discriminate. And, you know, there's like total hyperbole about what was in this memo, which in fact basically just restates some basic tenets of religious liberty, reminds people of the Hobby Lobby decision. Potentially, maybe builds a little more wiggle room into whether freedom of conscience applies to organizations as opposed to just individuals, although, again, the Supreme Court basically already did that in the Hobby Lobby decision. You know, actually may do a little bit of good in that it seems to open the door ever so slightly for non-explicitly religious but principled or moral objections to adhering to certain mandates about the provision of birth control. Although, to be clear, sex, gay, birth control, like none of those words appear in this memo. It was very much a general statement of restating the law. People were in the mood to be hysterical
about
this.
Slavery didn't appear in the Constitution, but we all knew that it was written, you know, about slavery.
It is about this, but I think the idea, which was very clearly being pushed by advocacy organizations, that Jeff Sessions wrote a memo which said that which he almost certainly believes, which is that it's, you know, birth control should be totally, you know, prohibited, or God even knows, like, you know, we should go back to home remedies and prayer. But that's not what was in this memo. It was nothing like that.
Coca-Cola douches, you know, they worked for our grandma.
You know,
I walked up to
describing specific home remedies for contraception and decided not to do it. And then you dove right into the Coca-Cola douche. So that's where we are now, I guess, as a country and as a podcast.
You know, it was particularly hard to get those before Coke. When Coke was still just being dispensed
Lysol
at soda
douches.
Fountains.
That was a thing. Hard to, Lysol, yeah. My friends.
Wasn't yeah. Lysol? Lysol was originally for the female body. No, but wait, I want to go back to the, you know, the Hobby Lobby case, and I've argued with Slate about this, and I suspect I'll argue with everybody on this call. I think it was incorrectly addressed. You know, there are religious exceptions allowed, but Hobby Lobby, like under existing law, like nobody would say, oh, you know, well, Hobby Lobby has a religious liberty to discriminate against black people. They don't want black people coming in. But Hobby Lobby claimed, you know, that after Obamacare mandated that they give, you know, that they cover birth control, that their rights were being violated, even though before Obamacare passed, they were actually covering certain drugs that they later said were, oh, you know, these are abortifacients, so we can't have them. It's a private company, a privately held company whose main function is to make money for its owners who happen to be religious. They're categorically different, I think, than a nonprofit organization like the Little Sisters of the Poor, who also brought a mandate. And I think it's worth being realistic about this. These are minor issues. That we either should be settling once and for all, and I totally agree with Matt that, you know, the government should not be involved in the provision of health care, and it certainly should not be, you know, screwing with businesses to cost onto businesses all sorts of mandates that they want. But having said that, if we're being serious about religious liberty, it doesn't stop Hobby Lobby's ability to proselytize or to do whatever they want as a privately held company to say, why don't you keep providing the same contraception that you were before Obamacare? There's a kind of hypocrisy here.
I really disagree with that characterization. I mean, I think this is, you know, this is a great, great example of how you set yourself on a slippery slope, right? If we have a scenario where we say, okay, first of all, you have to provide plans that have certain attributes, including a specific formulary. And then we say, we're going to parse the exceptions to that so finely that, you know, nuns are in,
no, but
yeah,
these
guys are out. Like,
I think it's worth fighting about. It's not so finely.
Every time there is like a further clarification of what exactly is covered by which healthcare plans by law, by federal law, then we have to do another round of press releases about the administration's cruel crackdown on women's rights. You know, that's
here. What
it's a big
what
issue.
Is what is the role for religious liberty? I mean, why are all of the religious liberty cases always backwards looking? And I guess I say this as somebody who is not religious, and I think I should have all sorts of exceptions to government mandates. And the problem is government mandates. It's not the status of religion, and it's hypocritical. I mean, let's be clear. It's hypocritical for Hobby Lobby to pay for one sort of pill and then say, oh, no, that totally contravenes our most deeply held belief about abortion, blah, blah, blah. It's like you're full of shit. You know,
I mean,
it's like, and you don't get a pass.
Whether or not Hobby Lobby is full of shit, it really does kind of miss the broader question here of should the federal government be allowed to mandate very specifically birth control?
Which most people consider a moral issue that has nothing to do with religious liberty.
I don't think anyone on this podcast disagrees that we'd like to have broader freedom of conscience in and define that outside of whether or not like you what you know crackers you eat on Sunday. But failing that, I don't think.
Boy, oh boy.
Failing well, that, I don't think we should
so
take it away from
Catholicism is
in the crackers.
Anti-Catholicism is the last redoubt of
I'm anti-ex-Catholic.
Well, let me put it this way, Catherine, because I
that's the only tenable position.
But it's kind of like when anti-tax people say, and you know, this is like what Grover Norquist will always say, like any tax cut is worth supporting or any tax loophole so that as you know, the mortgage interest deduction or the deduction for state and local taxes is okay because it means some people will pay less taxes. I get that in the same way that like a government mandate where you can carve out some type of exception, whether it's for religious reasons or something else, is good. But I think we should be fighting on a more principled ground of saying, you know, what the problem here is the government mandate and it is the individual mandate. And to bring it back to our earlier conversation, this is why the fucking Republicans deserve nothing but the back of voters' hands and certainly libertarian hands.
Non-aggression principle.
They have the exact place. You know, they're in the position where they could actually repeal and replace Obamacare or just repeal it, and they won't. And it's on them that all of these questions that come from the individual mandate, which is what all of this kind of stuff stems from.
I mean, I'm happy to come to your Republican Party sucks, you know, party for sure. I think that
it's a great gala every year.
It's a great gala. It's okay. Black tie. It's fabulous. But the thing about it is still
it's getting bigger. Yeah,
I think the difference between the mortgage interest rate deduction, the mortgage interest deduction, and the birth control exception for religious reasons is that the mortgage interest deduction, I can't talk today, is way more distortionary, right? Like by and large, people will wedge a few things into a religious exemption that probably don't naturally belong there. And I'd love to see the exception be bigger, but I don't think it's changing behavior or creating economic peril in the way that some of those tax cuts do. I just don't think it's the same.
Catherine, to go back to talking about Slade and the interpretation of the laws that Jeff Sessions clarifying. So the restriction to contraceptions is not actually ballooning. The actual law, I asked because the reaction was very very intense, very hyperbolic from the left in terms of, you know, this is a slight against all women. The birth control is going to be taken away. This is we're descending into the Handmaid's Tale and that kind of thing. So just to clarify, that's not the case.
I really don't think so. And what's more, I think all of the rhetoric around birth control in this context is already totally wrecked by the conflation of access versus versus like a total ban, right? So this is all, the whole debate is not about whether you can get birth control. Everyone who has a doctor can. It should be that everyone who doesn't have a doctor can too, over the counter. But it's about whether or not there is a mandate for all insurance policies to cover birth control in this way. And it is so different than making it impossible for women to get birth control, which is where advocates always want to go. You can get birth control even if your employer doesn't cover it. There are very, very cheap versions of the pill. There are other forms of birth control. The idea that somehow any of this, any of what's at stake here, is that women would have no ability to prevent contraception or to prevent conception during sex is so far from the reality that I don't even know how we can talk about it anymore.
That I will totally agree with, but then we also can talk about stuff. I mean, that's a rhetorical move that is as old as Moses, and is, you know, you see it in the gun debate.
If it's not subsidized, it's banned. Is a ridiculous place to be.
Yeah, or if we ban bump stocks, you know, then like for you know they're coming for your guns. And you know what though, I mean, realistically, there's some truth to that because like the 20-week abortion ban that the House passed, the people who support that are also the people who introduce every year a sanctity of life amendment or legislation that would ideally ban all abortion. So it's this is life in a democracy, right? Where things are always getting worse.
I want to bring up one more player in this debate the whole social conservative push. I didn't know a lot about Mike Pence until this election. I was kind of familiar with him, but he struck me as sort of a states' rights federalist Republican. However, he's usually portrayed as an extremely socially conservative, very much advancing social conservative agenda. Matt, is that a fair assessment of him? Is he a part of this, banned 20-week abortions and everything else wing? Or is
he part of the American Taliban, yeah. Matt?
He's a social conservative. When he was first up for vice president, Nick Gillespie of Reason.com wrote a very good primer on the scope of his views. He was, interestingly, for the sake not just of this conversation, but looking forward, he's also had one of the better. Not the best, but one of the better kind of track records as a fiscal Republican. He was able to inherit a lot of good work that had been done by Mitch Daniels. And it's actually it's worth comparing and contrasting the two in that Mitch Daniels, privatized stuff. He cut government. He inherited a god-awful mess, and he turned it around between 2005 and 2013. Pence came in and said, okay, well, we've done all that work. We can cut taxes. And he did. And so when the Trump administration decided to unveil their tax reform principles, they did it in Indiana using the Pence thing as a kind of symbolic jumping off point without ever sort of acknowledging the Daniels work that had gotten done. And I think that's a pretty good snapshot of where the Republican Party is right now. They don't want to do the Mitch Daniels work. The Mitch Daniels conservatism writ large on a national scale is dead in terms of functional Republican governance. They only do that in opposition, as mentioned before. And so now people just want to get the tax reform or get the tax cuts without having done the spade work to earn it all. But the other thing I'd say about Pence, and I realize I'm being a little tangential here, but he has on his team one of the most kind of libertarian friendly groups of advisors out there, which is kind of a curious thing. I don't know what they're doing. Some of them are working on the deregulatory reforms along with the aforementioned Mick Mulvaney. It's the good thing that Mulvaney is doing at OMB is that he's goosing the regulatory reform and deregulation that's happening there. The Pence policy team is also doing some of that work, which is good. But yes, he's always had this social conservative element. And as we saw from his dumb stunt with the national anthem at the Colts Niners game yesterday, he's very, very happy to play Trump's loyal culture warrior. And in that process is going to embarrass not just himself.
Well,
but the entire
and
country.
Also, I just want to point out on that 49ers Colts game, it took real courage to walk out on a 0-5 team playing a 1-3 team. The Colts and the 49ers are two of the worst teams in the NFL, and the national anthem was surely the highlight of that game, which ended up going to overtime.
Took about as much courage as it took me to walk out of a free Jackson Brown concert on Earth Day in 1990.
Wow, we're going to need to have that story on a separate outtakes of the podcast.
So Nick, a minute ago, you'd mentioned bump stocks, and I want to talk about that because that seems to be a place where both the NRA and the Democrats are converging, which does not happen that often, insofar as I know. Dianne Feinstein introduced a bill that would ban the sale and transfer of bump stocks. And I'm going to get feedback, I'm sure, on this because I'm not going to get this correct, but it is my understanding that a bump stock functionally allows a semi-automatic weapon to operate like it's an automatic weapon. Automatic weapons previously having been banned, so it's seen as a way of circumnavigating.
It's a hack that allows you to shoot a semi-automatic faster than you would if you had to actually pull the trigger with your finger each time.
Yeah, and the NRA and I think Paul Ryan, they've all kind of come out on this. So, I mean, first of all, Nick, do you think this is a good thing? Is this a positive development?
It's a real question. And I did a podcast with Jacob Solem of Reason last week where we talked about this. You know, The Second Amendment in its language does allow for regulation of arms. It isn't the same as the First Amendment, where, you know, Congress is not supposed to make any law respecting freedom of speech or abridging freedom of speech or freedom of religious liberty. Although there are cases where it does. You can't have a religion that's built around human sacrifice, I suppose. The Second Amendment has limits. It seems to me that, you know, banning bump stocks probably falls within that, even among, you know, the existing legal framework. It's not really going to do anything. I mean, it's not like this is the thing that will stop mass shootings from happening, which are already rare, et cetera. So there's, you know, there's that to consider. The thing about the NRA, though, is, you know, the NRA is an awful organization when it comes to gun rights, I think. And that's because they don't actually make principled defenses of much of anything. And they are constantly playing the culture war cards. Most recently, you know, they were silent for several days after Vegas. And then they came out and they blamed Hollywood movies, or Wayne LaPierre, the head of it, kind of made a comment.
Yeah, so they were irresponsible and teaching people with guns.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, fuck you. I mean, like, are you kidding? They did that in the 90s, too, when they were trying to stave off an assault rifle ban or a so-called assault weapons ban, which, by the way, was useless according to all the analysis of it. It had no effect. I mean, I'm in favor of as robust a Second Amendment as possible. But the NRA is constantly doing these kind of dick moves where it's like, oh, it's Hollywood's fault. Or if a cop kills a black guy, they're silent. If a white person gets caught in the crossfire, you know, then they're all pissed. I mean, they are effectively, in the same way that in many ways the feminist movement or organized feminism, to the extent that you can cite that, is a wing of the Democratic Party. The NRA is a special interest group that pushes a Republican agenda first. And kind of Second Amendment rights second, I think.
I'm just checking the boxes on all the groups that we can piss off by the end of the podcast. We're doing really well. We should get all sorts of interesting mail. I'll add to that, Nick, one of the things that Wayne LaPierre said in that same interview, I think it was on Hannity, that I think is a regular runner in NRA rhetoric, was he brought up, you know, liberals want to have armed guards. He was referencing Hollywood celebrities. They want to have armed guards, but they want to ban guns. Which I think is a false nomer in that I have a lot of Democrat friends. Very few of them think that there should be just an outright gun ban. The debate seems to me to be between whether we should have regulations or not have regulations. But it's oftentimes construed as the sort of all or nothing thing. Catherine, are there any regulations you'd like to see put into the mix?
I'm pretty absolutist on this, not least because I am very convinced by Brian Doherty's analysis of a sort of literature analysis of all the studies about the efficacy of various gun control measures that we've tried in recent years, none of which seem to actually reduce gun homicides. And I think that's really, really important to keep in mind. I mean, as libertarians, we don't want to make laws that do nothing or do harm. And I think that these laws, by and large, fall solidly into that category, not least because they radicalize people who believe that they are major infringements on their Second Amendment rights while not stopping people from getting killed by freaking guns. And the bump stock ban will absolutely fall in that category, should exist. What's more, though, the NRA has said while they are willing to thinking about someday maybe being okay with a bump stock ban, they want it to be done administratively. They think that the ATF should review its previous regulatory ruling on bump stocks. Meanwhile, Dianne Feinstein is saying, you know, there is no law we could have passed that would have stopped this particular shooting, the Vegas shooting, but it's not enough to regulatorily review the bump stock ban. We need a new law. And those are kind of the two poles of the debate. And those are two poles of a debate, neither of which will change the number of people who die from being shot by a gun in a homicide situation. So what the fuck are we doing?
To push a little bit, I mean, like with the bump stock, and I don't know enough about guns. It seems to me that with the mass shooting in Las Vegas, the counter argument to the bump stocks is that it actually made him, he was shooting more but less accurately. And so if he hadn't had the bump stock, it might have actually been worse or something to that effect. But from my vantage point, by you know, having this circumnavigation of an assault rifle ban, or not an assault rifle.
Circumnavigation is not the word you want, my man.
Well, that's
when you go all the way around the globe. You just mean circumventing.
Circumventing, thank you. Yes, they're not pulling a Magellan with rifles. Circumventing.
By the way, I want to point out, Magellan was not killed with guns. He was beaten to death by cannibals.
Thank you. I'll add that to the log. Hold on. So with a bump stock ban, let's say that in this one limited instance, it might have reduced death by like 5 to 10 people. I don't feel like the bump stock is something that's really critical to your right to self-defense. So
it doesn't matter. Most people feel like weed is not critical to your self-enjoyment. Like it's not. It's
check
not
the math
about
on that,
that.
One, Catherine. Check the math on that one. Most is a pretty strong claim. Ban the bump stocks.
I think that's true. And actually,
shit.
We have
ban,
now a 50.
Yeah.
Ban the bump stocks. Who cares? Who cares?
I care.
Ban the freaking bump stock.
It's pure signaling with no effect. And even if it might have made a difference in this specific incident is not statistically significant. And it's hard to say that after a bunch of people horribly died. But it
listen,
is true.
Every single time one of these things happens, what do the asshole libertarians say? And I say that with affection towards all of us, especially me. We say that your proposals would affect zero about this incident. Finally, with bump stocks, we have something that their proposal may have some relevance on this instance. So I feel like I want to give a cookie for at least finally.
This cookie giving is what's wrong with American politics.
Well,
this
no,
is
I
bipartisan
mean, listen,
bullshit
if,
at its worst.
I thought we were talking about the Jesus cookie.
Yeah, exactly.
When we talked
it's
about
not,
cookies before. The,
I always refer to
wafer.
The cracker as the cookie.
Yeah, it's also not just bump stocks that are being banned, right? There, Feinstein's language wants to ban anything that might increase the firing rate of a weapon. Super vague. Will just require more ATF rulings, which then the NRA can quibble
yeah,
about.
Which is one
and,
of the worst agencies
for
of all time.
Those reasons, right? I think that the NRA, which I agree is a god awful organization, and you know the way that they reacted to the Black Panthers brandishing weapons in 19 or holding weapons in 1968 says volumes about all of that. But I think
are we not allowed to say brandish?
Brandish is when you're like waving them around. I don't think that's what they were doing. I think they were just armed.
It's just such right? a better word.
When talking about guns. I know that I'm going to get the gun police are going to come after me hot and heavy as much as they did after the You've Come a Long Way, Baby cover with the improper holding of the gun.
We had a cover. There was a beautiful woman holding a gun. We were like, what could go wrong with this cover of a beautiful woman holding a gun? And the answer was her finger was arguably on the trigger. And thereby, she was demonstrating improper gun safety. We got some lettuce.
And I mean,
I was chastened.
Called out.
This is what happens when you let women drive. The next thing, they're voting, and then they're going around shooting people.
Or let them be managing editors of publications. I mean, you live in your.
None of it's a good idea.
Catherine, I'm gonna stoke more hate mail on this issue. You a moment ago mentioned that Feinstein wants to have legislation that would stop any type of acceleration of semi-automatic weapons. Why is that bad?
Because it's not going to change the actual outcomes of gun homicides, and it is going to be the sort of thing that justifies intrusions on people's private lives, that you, it's going to, when we find these, it's going to add charges to what may have been a totally innocent gun collection. And maybe they're fun. I don't know. Maybe it's just fun to go out and shoot cans.
I'm with you, Catherine, in this, because there is that, you know, there's that government, it's kind of like Munchausen syndrome by proxy, where you pass a law that has no chance in hell of actually affecting the outcome you want. And then its failure to do what you said it was going to do becomes the pretext by which to enact the next law and the next law and the next law. And I think that's fucked up. You know, it's, I mean, we should be able to have serious conversations about, you know, how do we actually reduce gun crime? And we have been doing it spectacularly over the last 25 years. I mean, violence by guns is down, you know, massively. The murder rate is more than halved. You know, these are good, great things, and we need to keep those in mind as the starting point of a conversation, as well as, you know, even after a mass shooting. And I think we lose a lot of that, partly, again, in many ways, the gun issue is mostly a culture war issue. Obama actually did very little about Second Amendment rights. He pissed off a lot of people who thought he was going to come in and actually try and take guns. But the NRA is still fundraising off of Obama, you know, gun taking rhetoric and things like that. We need to be focusing, I think, you know, as a country and certainly as a Congress on things that really matter. And at this point, the stuff that really matters is the last stuff that people are talking about, you know, repealing Obamacare, passing a budget, talking about coming up with a foreign policy consensus that will be enforced not just by Trump or by Rex Tillerson, but by the next president and the next president and the next president, where we actually say, OK, you know what, in a post-Cold War world, for fuck's sake, I mean, how many years are we since the Soviet Union collapse, a quarter of a century or more? And we still don't know, like, what basic American foreign policy is supposed to be about.
I need my bump stock when we go full Red Dawn. So that's my foreign policy.
Listen, we banned automatic weapons in 1986, and I think that was an effective ban, right? There's not a lot of automatic weapons out there. So I think there are real questions of efficacy on bump stocks because it is a mechanical thing. So it's an easy thing to hack. So automatic weapons are much more difficult to fabricate out of nothing, you know, despite all the best efforts of Cody Wilson and comrades. And so I think there's a good argument to be made that any bump stock ban would be much less efficacious. Also, bad circumnavigation, from what I understand. So I get that, but there is such a thing as an existing gun ban here that reflected an understanding, I think, that America has with itself, which is we have a robust right to armed self-defense, and that those rights are growing with time, especially over this past 20 years, where it's correlated pretty well with pretty great reductions in crime. That is continuing apace, but I think there's a broad feeling like you shouldn't be able just to put one finger pull and then engage in a turkey shoot.
I'm in that camp, Matt. I think, like, I agree everybody has a right to self-defense, and I think you should also be able to hunt deer. I don't see a need for a machine gun.
Yeah, but who are you to say, like, you know, like, fuck
this
you.
I don't think
you need sports coats. Get rid of sports coats. You know, who fucking needs a sports coat?
A machine gun's explicitly for killing lots of people,
isn't.
Right?
It's like, not explicitly. What is this? Like, I mean, like, you know,
You're gonna go turkey hunting with a machine gun?
Who have shot machine guns said it's one of the biggest thrills of their lives, and there's tons of ranges around because that's the way it's easiest to actually still own a fully automatic weapon. People like to go shoot Gatling guns. They like to shoot machine guns. They like to shoot high caliber stuff because it's fun. It's a rush. It's like going on a roller coaster. And simply because somebody can use something to kill people, it's not like, you know, I mean, I think it's really important. This is a point that Jacob Sullum makes a lot about guns and about drugs. And I think it's worth keeping in mind, which is that, you know, we try to, like, create magical impulses that inhere in objects, in a particular substance, in a particular piece of technology. No, it's humans. You know, the fault's not in our stars, and it's not in our machine guns, and it's not in LSD. It's in ourselves. We need to regulate that. The fact is that before the machine gun ban, there were, like, very few homicides that were committed or even crimes with automatic weapons. You know, the weapon of choice for homicides are like 22s.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the statistics are definitely there with you. Can I listened to the podcast that you did with Jacob Sullum, which was really good and really got into the nuts and bolts of most most of the proposals that are up. One of the things he brought up that I've heard multiple times before is this sort of this limit placed on Second Amendment rights, which is that you should be able to have any weapon that you could carry on you. So you couldn't have a tank, but you couldn't have a nuclear weapon, but you could have a machine gun. What is that just like a strict literal interpretation of the Second Amendment that people are getting that from? Or
I'd be curious as to what Matt and Catherine think about it as well as you, Andrew. It's like, it seems to me, if you know where libertarians really do need to do serious work is that, you know, what if you grant that there are restrictions or limits to rights, to the expression of rights, even ones guaranteed in the Constitution, where do you draw them? And if you're constantly saying, as I kind of am right here, you know, no limits on the Second Amendment, you know, then are you really serious? Or is it just a kind of dogmatically ideological position that is kind of hiding behind a libertarian frame to advance a kind of anarchist point of view? But you know, we do limit certain types of weapons, and then, you know, why not the next step? I mean, I think it's an interesting question and a legitimate one that libertarians need to grapple with more fully.
I think this is often a place where consequentialist arguments are more powerful than rights arguments, and people hide under their rights arguments. And, you know, the idea that the left owns the harm side of this debate is totally wrong. The idea that, well, you know, if you really cared about how many people died, we would ban all the guns. And that's not at all true. That doesn't at all reflect the actual reality that we live in, where there are, you know, 350 million guns in this country, and to institute a broad-based ban of any kind would be a civil rights and policing disaster of unknown proportions. And of course, that argument is distinct from the question of, okay, well, do you stop the future manufacturer of a very narrow specific thing? But again, there, I think there's a very strong case to be made that it just has no impact on the bottom line in terms of consequences. And that's worth considering, too. No impact means no action. That should be something that libertarians can agree on.
Well, Catherine, before we move on, can I own a tank?
Sure, bud.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate your
faith.
But, you know,
the license fee is going to be, because they're usually based either on axles or weight. And I think that's going to put a real dent in your budget.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to have to insure yourself for having a tank,
yeah, but
right?
I'm going to get a Tesla tank. So once I pay that initial
fee,
the electricity
Walmart
that I'm going to have to
parking lots or something to charge it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm going to make it up on the back end in terms of fuel efficiency.
I mean, Trump did just roll back the restrictions that Obama put on the practice of seconding military surplus to domestic law enforcement. So we can expect to see more cops with tanks pretty soon, I think, if my reading of that decision is correct.
Oh, and, you know, small town America, thanks him, because like that crime wave that's been happening in the couple of years where it was harder and harder for, you know, villages to get
to
tanks,
get the tanks
and,
yeah,
armored personnel characters.
Anyway, I think if we have tanks in the hands of domestic law enforcement, the only choice is to give Andrew Heaton a tank.
Okay, finally, a position we can all agree on. I should have a tank. But before we go, one of the people that has also been leveling criticism at the NRA is Harvey Weinstein.
It's a hell of a segue there.
But that's what he did.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Talk about
he
when
did it. It was crazy. That letter
spent the past
at the end of the
40
letter.
Years,
he did.
You know,
yeah,
like,
it was
you know, coercing women suggestively, or like trying to get them to massage me. But now I know the error of my ways, and I'm going to make Wayne LaPierre retire. I mean, that's literally what he said in a statement to the New York Times, getting caught with his robe opening indiscreetly.
I think it's amazing that he truly thought a defense, like a good strategy in defense of his behavior, would be to just say, hey, dudes, I'm a liberal.
Yep. Well, and he also grew up in a different era or something like that, which implies that it was apparently appropriate at some point in history to rampantly sexually harass someone.
I mean, it was certainly more common. I don't know.
And we are
ever
talking about Hollywood, where it's not like, you know, the casting couch, you know, is as old as
Harvey Weinstein didn't invent that.
Yeah. I think Carl Laemmle did, or one of the early film pioneers, probably.
Well, we've got him. We've also got the Tim Murphy sex scandal. So it's been a fun week for sex scandals.
Well, I love the Republican sex scandals where it's so Tim Murphy is an 8-term, 65-year-old married congressman who was having an affair with a woman. He's a psychologist who specialized in child psychology and wrote books about curing aggression in children and adults. He had in the past year, according to his chief of staff in a Politico article, he had 100% turnover of his staff because he couldn't communicate with them except by yelling and screaming and insulting them. But he not only was he having an affair, which is bad for a social values guy, but then he apparently told his mistress when there was a pregnancy scare and she was married as well to get an abortion. Even though he had just signed the 20-week he had sponsored and voted for the 20-week abortion ban. And in the grand scheme of things, Harvey Weinstein is a phenomenally grotesque human being. Tim Murphy also, and what worries me more, Harvey Weinstein is like, he was the major Hollywood bundler in 2008 and 2012 for Democrats. So he's a power player, and every Democratic politician of note, got money from him. Some are rejecting it, some are just staying silent. But, Tim Murphy strikes me as ultimately a more reprehensible character because he has his finger on the button that can vote to say, no, you're not allowed to have an abortion. No, you're not allowed to do this. He's against gay rights. He is actually implementing laws or trying to implement laws that would, immediately restrict a lot of people's rights. And I find him, if you have to choose, and of course you don't, I find him more reprehensible than a Weinstein in this case.
I'm enjoying the late-breaking evolution of people's awareness of the problem here, particularly Democrats and close associates of Weinstein. Like this, it reminds me of Obama saying, like, "Oh my God, I met some gay parents at Malia's school and realized I was wrong all along about gay marriage." It's like, oh wait, hold on, really? There's sexual harassment happening in Hollywood.
Harvey Weinstein, who a couple of years ago claimed various outbursts, including putting a reporter in a headlock and kicking him out of a party, New York Observer reporter, on blood sugar spikes, and that he actually carried M&Ms in his pockets to regulate his blood sugar pressure. Yeah, Weinstein's been known, for decades as a complete asshole.
And meanwhile, Donald Trump can say, "Oh, it doesn't surprise me," when he hears the news. So this is this kind of weird liminal space that we're in, where powerful people who were in a position to do something about this before but didn't are now pretending like they're learning about it for the first time. I kind of want to let people have the cover of that hypocrisy if it moves us in the right direction, but yuck.
Yeah, I look at there's a lot of liberal zealotry that comes out of Hollywood, and then you look at it, and it's not a particularly egalitarian place. There's incredible wealth discrepancies, and there's instances like this where there's someone who's a outspoken progressive proponent who's at the same time undermining anything that is actually being pushed in terms of just equal respect and dignity and that kind of thing. Catherine, do you think that he's given or was given any type of free pass by virtue of being liberal? Do you think that is a thing that happens, or am I being unfair and saying that that's sometimes a scapegoat?
I think it's telling that he thought that was an appropriate thing to include in his response to the Times. I don't know about the past, but it seems very likely to me that he wouldn't have thrown that in there if it hadn't worked before. It strikes me he said at some point, "Oh, here's your settlement for sexual harassment, and also I'm giving money to a good cause." And people have said, like, "All right, we'll let it go." And he just didn't quite appropriately gauge whether or not it was going to work this time.
I think there's a sign of alarming lack of health in the fact that not just him, but whatever idiotic crisis managers he's working with thought that this was even a possible line of deflection. That says something pretty bad about the way that the organization of political hatreds has become a crutch for people who are trying to swindle you about any number of things. However, it's a sign of health that I don't see a lot of people buying it. There doesn't seem to be a lot of people like, "Oh, come on, you know what? He really is taking on Wayne LaPierre. So maybe we should give him a break." I think the reaction a revulsion, not just to his actions with potted plants and other things, but his attempt, just naked attempt to try to change the subject in that way by appealing to people's base political instincts, is a sign that maybe there's some glimmer of hope for our dreary and despicable nation yet.
I think it's also worth talking about this in terms of a kind of massive generational or epochal shift away from certain old habits, in the same way that people used to use the N-word more casually in conversation up through the early 70s, probably, or words about gays and things like that. I mean, through the 1980s, Three's Company and other things were still doing Tinkerbell jokes, which are unimaginable now in many ways, and not out of a sense of like a shrill kind of PC nature, but it's just society has moved on. And in that sense, I think Weinstein, it's kind of ironic that him and Tim Murphy, who's 65, and Hugh Hefner dying in the past week, there's a shift away from a kind of post-war masculinity that was not only tolerated, but it was really valorized in many ways. It's harder to get away with that, and it's increasingly difficult to. And I think that will, that continues, and that's kind of social progress. Whether or not it'll ever be bleached out, because, part of the thing about Weinstein, too, is that not all of the women that he had assignations with and stuff like that were unwilling. Camille Paglia has talked a lot about this, that there's always a sign that a sense that there's only male power in any given situation. It's actually much more complicated than that. But, the rules have changed in a significant way, and they'll continue to change and evolve. And hopefully, and I think they have been in a more egalitarian, in a better fashion, even though, Andrew, as you mentioned, Hollywood is no place to look for moral guidance in its, either in the products they produce, but also in the way that they conduct business.
Well, then I'll take that as a positive sign that society is in fact getting better because we're willing to condemn people like Harvey Weinstein and Tim Murphy. And with that, we'll close the podcast and just agree that I am the new paragon of masculinity and I should own a tank. So thank you all for your input. This has been the Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us and rate us on iTunes. And thank you for listening.